The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the SoxProspects.com podcast. Today is February 23rd, 2015. Happy Yoan Moncada Day, everybody. This is an emergency podcast, or breaking news podcast, whatever you want to call it, that we had to get out today because the Red Sox signed one of the biggest international free agent prizes in quite some time, at least from the amateur/not-major-league-ready category. Kind of a momentous day in the system, and we wanted to get something out to you. We're going to be interviewing Ben Badler from Baseball America, who is their guy on the international beat. He's been all over the Moncada story since it came out that Moncada was going to come play in America. I want to welcome you. Thank you for downloading. My name is Chris Hatfield. I'm executive editor here at the website, and I am joined today, per usual, by managing senior... all things great editor Matthew Hegel. Hello, Matt.
Hey, Chris. Exciting day. Of course, it broke right in the busiest time of my workday, but yes. You know, exciting to get a big prospect and excited to talk to Ben coming up.
It actually, I'll say this, broke while I was driving my mother to the airport back from a weekend visit here in D.C. at Sox Prospects South. So. That was a fun drive back to D.C. before I went into work. We're also joined by our director of scouting, Mr. Ian Kundle. Hello, Ian.
Hi, guys. How are you doing? My morning wasn't it exciting. I opened my email, and there was an email from Chris Hatfield about it, and that's how I found out.
All right. That works. That works.
I had my phone, and I couldn't go on Twitter, and there happened to be an email about it, so that was good.
I live to serve. I'm here for
you, Ian. I appreciate it. More updates would be good.
Yeah. I'll update you on what I'm eating. Just follow me on Instagram or something. So we're pleased to have Ben on. I guess we should probably jump right into it, gentlemen. I should mention, please rate and review us on iTunes. It helps get the podcast out to some new ears. Helps us with our searchability or whatever algorithm iTunes uses for that. You can follow us on Twitter. The site account is at Sox Prospects. I'm at SP Chris Hatfield, HATFIELD. Matt, where can they Twitter you?
It's at Matt Hegel, SP, and HUEGEL.
And Mr. Ian.
At Ian Kundle, IANCUNDALL.
Awesome. Sorry, Matt, for cutting you off there. I did not mean to this time.
No problem.
So let's just jump right into it then. We were able to talk to Ben Badler for what is an action-packed interview. This is going to be a listen that you should pay attention to as opposed to just throwing in the background, I think. That's safe to say. It's in a good way drinking from the information fire hose. We had a great interview with him. So without further ado, here's our interview with Ben. Okay, and now we're joined by Ben Badler, national writer over at Baseball America, who focuses on all things prospects and, of course, importantly for us today, international players in the international amateur scene. And with today being such a big day for the Red Sox internationally, signing Yoan Moncada, we wanted to have Ben on. Ben, thank you so much for joining us tonight. We appreciate it on such short notice.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah. Well, I guess we should... basically get right into it. You've been working the Cuban beat kind of recently, it seems, for more than anyone on the national scene over the past year plus, maybe even longer than that. But, you know, the Cuban scene, especially since, you know, Jose Abreu and looking back even to Puig and Cespedes before that, you've been all over the Cuban scene, and especially Moncada right from the start. So why don't we start with this? the player the Red Sox just signed, what did they get? I'm seeing from your writing a few plus tools and the chance for at least another, I guess. What is this player they just got?
Yeah, it's it's not a guy who's going straight to the big leagues. He's going to need at least a year plus in the minor leagues. But when it all comes together, by the time this guy's in his early to mid 20s, this is a potential impact franchise type player. I mean, you look at all the tools that he has. It's the bat speed is plus, if not well above average. There's very few guys that have that kind of bat speed. The raw power is a 60 on the 20-80 scale. He's really, really big, really strong. He might even have more power than that down the road. The run tool, the speed is at least a 60 run right now. Maybe he slows down a step or two just because of the body type that you're looking at. And it's not a guy, that classic lively type body, but he's extremely athletic. He's got at least a plus arm. I know some scouts have put a 70 on the arm. And then obviously the biggest question mark with any player is the bat, projecting what the bat is going to be like at the big league level. And with Moncada, he's a switch hitter. He's much better from the left side than the right side, but all the evidence suggests that this guy is going to hit and hit a lot when he does get to the big leagues. It's a compact swing, especially from the left side, where the bat stays in the zone a long time. And he has a really good track record of hitting. I mean, granted, we haven't seen him do it against professional pitching yet, even against, the lower level minor league pitching, but this guy's track record, whether it's just completely annihilating the competition in the Cuban junior leagues, they have 16 under leagues and 18 under leagues there. He was always the best player in those leagues. He played on the Cuban junior national team and the youth national team multiple times. He was always the best player on the team, both in terms of his performance and just in terms of the raw tool jumping out to scouts. This is a guy who's really been on the scouting radar since he was 15 years old. So, the other question with him really is, where is he going to play in the field? He's not going to play shortstop, but doesn't really matter because he's going to play second base, third base. He even has really the speed where you could put him out in center field if you wanted to try him out there. I'm not sure that's the best way to use him, but this is a guy who's got a lot of versatility, a lot of athleticism, and it's just really uncommon to see a guy with this many above-average tools, and then when you combine that with a pretty fair amount of polish for his age, that's why we have him as the number 10 prospect in baseball right now.
Yeah, thanks again for coming on, Ben. You mentioned how muscular he is and how, we've sort of heard he's now possibly up to 220. Do you see that as being a good thing? Does it hint towards a potential corner outfield spot? Do you think that's a possibility, or do you see him as a future infielder?
I think he has the ingredients to be an infielder. I mean, a lot of times we see when guys are, are 19 years old. I remember Nolan Arenado. He was a teenager coming up in the Rocky system, and this guy, the question was, can he stay at third base? Is his body going to get too big? He's not a great defender at third base. His footwork isn't great. Granted, he has the arm strength, but, is this guy going to end up at first base? And now, to think back on that, it's like, well, Nolan Arenado is like a Gold Glove caliber third baseman. It seems kind of wild to think about now. And Robinson Cano, when he was coming up as a prospect, was not really I think he was topped out at like the number two prospect one year in the Yankee system. So it wasn't like he was under the radar by any means, but I'm pretty sure he never made a top 100 prospects list. And the question mark too on him was, is this guy going to be any better than like a fringy type defender at second base? And again, another guy who just sort of worked his way into becoming an above average defender at second base. So, you take positions like second base, third base. I think a lot of times if a guy has the athleticism and some of the raw ingredients to play the position, you can see guys work and really transform themselves defensively there. Now, you mentioned the body type. It's not like he's carrying it in the wrong way. I mean, if just from seeing pictures and then some video of him recently, he's pretty well put together. But obviously the question is, look, once he gets older and starts to add possibly even more weight and more size, is that going to, slow him down? Yeah, probably to some degree. Everybody sort of tends to lose some speed in that body type in particular. I think you're going to see him lose a step or two, but I think he's going to have plenty of quickness and athleticism to be able to play in the infield. But yeah, I mean, if you wanted to put him in a corner outfield spot, even if he slows down into an average or a slightly above average runner, you combine that and his arm strength. Those are all the tools. If you wanted to put him in the outfield and give him enough reps and experience there, those are all the tools for him to be an above average defender in a corner outfield spot and maybe even play some center field given the speed that he has right now.
Mm-hmm. Now that we know what system he's going to be going into, Ben, it's a little less abstract of a question of where he'll start. I think obviously kind of the real answer is going to be that the Red Sox will evaluate him once they get into camp. But now that we can kind of see, who the other guys at some positions are, combined with how ready Moncada might be, where do you think he might start? Is it, you've said A ball, I think, on Twitter. Do you have any ideas in terms of maybe which affiliate might having guys around, like the potential for Rafael Devers in Greenville, perhaps, or a Michael Chavis in Greenville might push him up to a Salem? What do you think might be where he starts? And I guess that kind of goes along with that, how long he might need in the minor leagues before he's ready.
Yeah, I think he's advanced enough to go to Salem. I mean, the good thing about Moncada is, the Red Sox, I think, were probably open to having him play multiple positions. I haven't talked to them specifically about this yet, but, this is a guy who could play. He has a lot of history at second base. He could play third base. By the time he gets to the big leagues, you're not really certain who's going to be where at that position for the Red Sox in a couple of years down the road. But I think it would probably make a lot of sense to get him, repetitions at both spots, maybe even use him some in the outfield. I love Rafael Devers, so I do think it's, they want to get him as much playing time as possible and try to, get him especially defensive reps at third base, because that's really a big question mark on him about whether he's going to be able to stay at that position, because the bat is just tremendous. So I do think Moncada is polished enough to handle an assignment to the Carolina League. He probably gets to double A pretty quickly, I would think, if he's hitting well in the Carolina League. But I think it's probably too aggressive to send him immediately to double A. I mean, this is a guy who, I think the last time he must have played a game was December 2013, at least in a competitive game in Cuba. So, he's been working out and training, but it's a little bit different when you get into a live game and trying to get used to the grind of a 140-game season in the minor leagues. So to send him to double-A, I think, would be a little bit premature, especially taking a kid from, who spent his whole life in Cuba and a little bit of time in Guatemala and more recently in Florida, and say, hey, go up to Portland in April and see how you like that. So to me, I think all the factors point toward the Carolina League really being the best spot for him to open, probably get to double-A at some point by the middle of the season or by the end of the year. And then, in 2016, maybe by the All-Star break, he's up there. At that point, I think he'd still be, 21 years old? So he'd still be really young. I think the Red Sox have kind of seen what the what's happened with guys like Bogarts and Bradley, these guys who've been, they've shown everything they could possibly show in the minor leagues to be ready for the big leagues, and then there's still that transition period for some guys who don't immediately take off. So I don't think it's going to be an ownership group or a baseball operations group that's going to be pressured by the big financial outlay that they made for him to rush him up there. But I think on talent alone, this is a guy who probably could be up there within, in a year and a half or 2 years, assuming he does stay healthy.
What kind of tool do you see as his speed? Do you see his speed being an impact tool once he makes it to the majors, or do you see him becoming more of an above average runner than plus, which is what has been reported at this point?
Yeah, I think he's a 60 runner. It's interesting in Cuba. You see a lot of guys who are, you know, there's even guys who are 70, 80 runners who, for whatever reason, they just don't steal bases well in Cuba. They don't really have an impact on the game in terms of stealing bases. They're a lot better going first to third than they are trying to steal second base. I wish I had a better answer for why that is. I talk to a lot of scouts about it, and I watch, you know, at least one or sometimes two games every day from these, in Cuba. But it's, for whatever reason, it's the base stealing technique there and the jumps and the reads that these guys get. It's really just in general really bad. I mean, we've seen guys come over like, you know, Cespedes and Puig, guys who have really good speed, and they just can't, you know, steal bases. And Leonis Martin, when he was in the minor leagues, kind of look up his minor league numbers and his caught stealing rate or his stolen base success was really, really bad. I mean, the Rangers basically had to take him aside and say, look, you know, we need to give you some training on how to do this, because clearly this was not something you were taught in the past. So the good thing about Moncada is you're getting him at 19 years old, so you can teach him that and give him some time to learn how to steal bases, learn how to pick your spots, and improve his instincts on the base path. So I do think that, yeah, he has a chance to be a 2020 type guy if the Red Sox can develop that base stealing technique with him and teach him how to take advantage of that speed.
Mm-hmm. I know a lot of times, Ben, when we see these Cuban players come over, we just kind of assume the tag of Cuban defector. But in this case, it's a little bit different, and I don't know how much of this we even know about at this point, or what you know you can even say. But Moncada's situation, I understand it to be a little bit different. Can you kind of explain what his situation is with the Cuban government and his circumstances of coming over to the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, I'll try to explain some of it, because some of it I don't even know. Because
right.
I'm sure there's a lot that even the Red Sox probably don't know themselves. It sounds like he was allowed to leave through legal immigration. They just gave him a passport and allowed him to leave. So why the Cuban government would, you know, reportedly do that, it's a great question. I mean, this is a guy who was clearly one of their top young star players. He'd been a star on all their junior and youth national teams. This is a country that cares deeply about winning international tournaments like the World Baseball Classic and other smaller international tournaments that really don't get as much public press. But he left through legal immigration with a passport. He's not the first guy who's done that. There have been some other guys, it sounds like, who've gone that route as well, but it's definitely something that has raised more questions than there are answers right now.
And then as far as the negotiation went, as far as you know, did it basically come down to the Yankees and the Red Sox, or what other major players were there, and were any of them right in the bidding till the end as well?
From what I heard, it sounded like, yeah, a lot of it was the teams that were expected to be in there, the Red Sox, the Yankees. It sounds like the Padres were in there pretty hard, and the Dodgers. I'm not sure exactly what their offer was, but it sounds like they were in there pretty hard. So, you know, I think a lot of teams, like every team was interested in this guy to some extent, but, you know, when you're talking about, a $30 million plus bonus and then a $30 million tax that you're going to have to pay on July 15th, there's a lot of teams that just said, look, you know, we like this guy a lot, but we're not going to offer him, you know, $15 million and, you know, some sham offer that we know is not going to get accepted. So I think a ton of teams would love to have had this guy and probably would have made an offer, but I think a lot of them just realized, wow, this is more than our ownership group is willing to be able to fork over right now.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we've discussed here on the podcast before, Ben, the situation the Red Sox were in, where they were already over their bonus pool for this signing period. So it made a lot of sense for them because they were already incurring penalties. But one thing that we're starting to see talked about a little bit is how this might kind of portend for the future, whether there's going to be an international draft. Not that this is new or a new discussion, but we're starting to see it pop up a little bit. Drew Smiley tweet that's gotten some play about, you know, talking about how U.S. draftees get a sixth of what Moncada just got or something like that. Do you see this, you know, leading towards international draft very soon, you know, maybe in the next CBA or even before then? And I guess to go along with that is, you know, are teams like the Red Sox and Yankees that have already gone over, and we're hearing the Dodgers might go way over in this next signing period, are these teams gambling on the fact that an international draft is going to be coming in soon?
I think Moncada signing for a $30-plus million bonus is going to be a partial contributor toward MLB being strongly motivated to pursue an international draft, which will, you know, the primary reason will be cost control. If you have an international draft, whether it's one draft or two drafts, you can control your costs if you're the owner. You can't really do that completely under the system they have right now. So whether it's somebody like Moncada or a couple other guys like Roberto Baldaquin, the Cuban shortstop that the Angels signed for $8 million, or Yoan Lopez, who just signed for $8.25 million with the Diamondbacks, you know, those two guys, when they were in Cuba, were, you know, young, intriguing guys, but not the kind of guys you would have thought would be, you know, pool-busting signings, because there's a lot of players who are still in Cuba who are better than those guys who would be subject to the bonus pools. So I think MLB is saying, whoa, if these guys are getting $8 million each, I mean, Moncada is a special case. Everybody knew that if this guy ever left, you know, every team's going to be willing to blow past their bonus pool to get this guy. But these guys were not expected to be that caliber of player. So that's going to really throw off what MLB was planning for. Okay, these bonus pools, which are really designed for the July 2nd kids, the guys who are coming out of, you know, 16-year-old kids from Dominican Republic, Venezuela, now all of a sudden these teams are just blowing past to sign these, you know, Cuban players who are not really elite premium prospects. I mean, we didn't even put Baldaquin and Lopez in our top 100. They were eligible for it. You know, they're solid prospects, but they're really not at that level yet. So I think you look at those factors. You look at just what other teams like the Red Sox and, you know, the Rays going over their bonus pool, or really what the Yankees did this year, which I would imagine there's not a lot of teams that can spend. They spent about $17 million just on, you know, these July 2nd kids, almost all 16-year-old kids out of Latin America, and then they're going to have to pay about a $17 million tax just on top of that. So they're spending about $30, $35 million just on these July 2nd guys. You know, I don't know how many teams are actually going to be able to replicate that, but, you know, the Dodgers, I'm sure, could. There's plenty of other teams that could. If you miss on, you know, some of those guys, so be it. But if one of them turns into just an everyday guy, an everyday above-average player, I think you're more than getting your money's worth out of that. So I think MLB is looking at all these factors and realizing, all right, you know, this system that we put in place does not control costs. The owners don't like that, and you look at the aggregate of everything, and you're going to say, all right, let's make a stronger push for an international draft in the next CBA.
You mentioned some of that, a lot of that talent that's coming out of Cuba recently. Do you expect that run to continue of this talent, and what are some of the names that might be the bigger names coming out soon, and have any of them been linked to the Red Sox at this point that you've heard of?
Yeah, I don't think there's anybody who's at the level of Moncada, at least not in terms of like the young up-and-coming guys. Guys would be like the under-23 pool subject guys. Those are the guys that the Red Sox obviously are going to be ineligible from signing. But the older guys who are not subject to the pools, those guys are, you know, anybody can still sign down. Those guys are basically just like any other major league free agent. So it's another advantage for the Red Sox there. I mean, the top guys coming out now, you know, out right now are Guillermo Heredia, the center fielder who was the center fielder on their Cuban national team at the World Baseball Classic a couple of years ago. Really good defender. in center field who probably doesn't really fit what wouldn't fit in for the Red Sox right now. Although you never know, I guess, with what they're doing. But really good defender. Some question marks on the bat. He was a switch hitter who actually stopped switch hitting, and now he's a left-handed throwing, right-handed hitter. Kind of unusual. Although he may go back to switching now once he's starting to showcase, we'll see. But he's out. Vladimir Gutierrez, really good pitching prospect at Cuba, who's been up to 19-year-old kid up to 93 miles an hour with a plus curveball and a body that's like 6'2", 6'3", 170. He's all lanky arms and legs. He's a really good pitching prospect. I think you can project on the fastball for him to be throwing in the mid-90s. There's a kid, Yadier Alvarez, who's in the Dominican Republic right now, who's really a pop-up guy, very erratic with his control. Pretty wild when I saw him, especially early on in the game, but he settled down. He's been up to 97 miles an hour. And then that's the tricky thing about Cuba is you never know for sure who's going to come out when. So you got to be tracking these guys all the time before they leave Cuba. That's why we're always trying to get as much info on these guys before they leave as possible. I mean, Gutierrez, I think I've seen somewhere between like 15 and 20 times already. Even though he's so young and hasn't pitched much outside of Cuba at all, but you never know who's going to leave next, and that's what makes it tricky, especially with these bonus pools. I mean, they have a second baseman there right now, Jose Miguel Fernandez, who was a second baseman on the Cuban national team, and right now he's suspended in Cuba. He's not playing. He hasn't played since October. The word is, usually when these guys are suspended, it's for attempting to defect. So he's still in Cuba. I mean, you can obviously sort of connect the dots and say, all right, well, if this guy's not playing in Cuba, there's certainly a possibility he might come out and something might change in his status. But you never know when somebody might be available, and then they got to go through the whole process of getting residency, which is now been a little bit simplified, or at least the process after residency, because you don't need that specific license, because Major League Baseball changed its policy in terms of that requirement. But it's tricky because you just never know who's going to come out when. You just always have to be on these guys and be evaluating these guys just in case somebody ever does pop up.
Cool. I guess one thing we wanted to ask you about, Ben, while we had you, is the two pitchers who the Red Sox had already gone over their bonus allotment for. One out of the Dominican and one out of Venezuela. There were two pitchers in Anderson Espinoza and Christopher Acosta. What can you tell us about those two guys? We kind of pride ourselves in having seen pretty much everybody in the system, but they haven't really pitched yet. So what are kind of the scouting reports on them, and in terms of maybe what we can expect? Are these two guys who may come stateside this year, or do you think they're kind of slotted for a year in the Dominican before they come over to the U.S.?
Those are two of the best pitching prospects in Latin America. Either, certainly if you want to be conservative, I would say two of the best four. We had them as two of the best three available. Anderson Espinoza, the first pitcher out of Venezuela, he was the best pitching prospect in the class. The guy who, the knock on him is he's undersized. He's maybe pushing 6 feet, but he's got a fastball that's been up to 94 miles an hour. And it's a really advanced curveball for his age, and the feel for pitching is really advanced beyond his years. That's something with both these guys, and with a lot of the Red Sox international amateur pitchers that you've seen him sign, whether it's a guy like Jonathan Diaz or some of these other guys that they've signed at the amateur level out of Latin America. It's a lot of guys with really good touch and feel. I think there's more projection too with Espinoza, even though he's not a big guy. You don't think of it as a classically projectable body. When I talk to scouts about him, they're like, no, he's got long arms, big hands, and a really quick arm. A lot of things that point toward, the development of more velocity down the road and the continued development of the off-speed pitches, especially the changeup that, he hasn't had to throw much, but it seems like he's already shown some feel for at a really early age. Now, Christopher Acosta is the more classic pitcher type body that you see out of a young Latin American pitching prospect that that teams tend to sign for a lot of money. But him too, he's got a lot of polish for his age. He throws a lot of strikes. His fastball is a lot of movement and sink on it, especially from like a bit of a lower arm slot with him, and a really advanced changeup for his age too. You don't really see 16-year-old Dominican kids with any sort of a changeup most of the time, but his is actually, you know, you projected to be a potential above-average pitch down the road. The question mark on him is the breaking ball. Some of that's probably tied into the lower arm slot, but he's so young that it's got time to develop probably into a slider at some point and see how that goes. But it's really young, projectable guys with really promising arms. It's just you're talking about 16-year-old kids, so the now stuff, especially on the major league scale, is never going to wow you or blow you away. There's always projection involved in these guys, but you know, if you're going to invest in young pitching in Latin America, those are two of the best guys you could have gotten.
Cool. And I guess one more question before we let you go, Ben. We got a reader question from James over in England, Whitley Bay, England, which I have no idea where that is. But I know you answered one of these questions on Twitter today, but the second one, I don't know. He just asked, one, are the Red Sox now a top three farm system? And two, is there under 25 talent? So you rope in the Bogarts and Betzes of the world. Is there under 25 talent the best in baseball? What are your thoughts on those?
That's a good question. I think I would not put them as the best farm system. I still think that what the Cubs have, you know, with Chris Bryant and Addison Russell and Jorge Soler. I mean, Schwarber. The impact guys they have at the top of the system are ridiculous. I can't believe they got Addison Russell and Jeff DeMarga right. trade. But what you know the Red Sox have is, I mean, I love the system. I do think it's moved up from a top five system. It's you could probably put them right behind the Cubs right now at number two because at least you can make a good case for it because they have impact star level talent at the top with guys like Moncada, who we have as the top guy in the system, Blake Swihart. I think Manuel Margot is. I think he's just generally underrated. I mean, this is a guy who has all the impact tools to be an impact player in a premium position, a guy who can beat you on both sides of the ball. I mean, this is a system that has, you know, the high level, you know, star talent, but then there's also a depth of it behind them in the lower levels, not just with, you know, guys like Rafael Devers, who we were talking about earlier, but, you know, all the way down to, you know, these newer July 2nd signings that they just added, guys like Espinoza and Acosta and guys down to the GCL like Javier Guerra. I mean, most systems just don't have that combination of impact talent and, you know, legitimate depth. I mean, every team can really say, oh, you know, we have depth, but really it's just like, oh, this guy is, you know, maybe a fourth outfielder if everything breaks right. I mean, the Red Sox have a depth of guys who could be impact talent, and you just don't see that in most organizations. And in terms of the under 25 talent, yeah, I mean, that's to me what's exciting about them is that, you know, guys like Mookie Betts and Xander Bogaerts, who, yeah, maybe some of the shine has come off Bogaerts after his last year, but I think that it's a mistake if anyone's sleeping on him. I think he's got a potential to be a star player. Mookie Betts is I would not trade him for in pretty much any deal. I think he's got a potential to be a star. I even still like Jackie Bradley a lot. I mean, you're talking about a guy who's as good of a defender as you're going to find in the big leagues, who has a track record of hitting all the way up through the minor leagues and really had a terrible year last year at the plate. But I think he's still young. I think he's got a chance to turn that around and find what made him so successful all the way up through the minor leagues. So yeah, there's a ton of talent right now in the farm system, but yeah, there's a lot of good young talent they have at the big league level too. There's really not many teams in the games right now that can match that young talent that the Red Sox have throughout the farm system and throughout the major league team as well.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thanks to James over in England for the question. And Ben, we want to thank you for coming on. Everyone, please make sure that you go check out Ben Badler's stuff over at Baseball America. And Ben, on how can people follow you on the Twitters?
At Ben Badler. So
very easy.
Should be one of the easier ones.
Excellent. Excellent. Cool. Well, Ben, thank you so much for coming on short notice. Definitely a very exciting day. And maybe hopefully we'll talk to you again in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Ben. Look forward to that.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Ben.
Appreciate it.
All right. You got it.
All right, well, that was our interview with Ben Badler. We want to thank Ben once again for coming on very short notice. Very gracious of Ben to join us in our little podcast, our modest little podcast. But great stuff from Ben. Really knows his stuff. Make sure you go check him out on Baseball America. It's must-read stuff if you want to have any clue on what's going on internationally. He does things like rank the top 20 players in Cuba, which you literally can't get anywhere else. So great stuff from him.
Yeah, and as you heard, he actually watches quite a few Cuban games.
Yes, yeah.
He knows what he's talking about.
He does. Late-breaking news that we should add, we had heard rumored, but we actually weren't able to ask Ben about because we only saw it after we finished with him. But David Hastings, who is the CPA, who is Moncada's agent, has said that the Red Sox have also agreed to sign Carlos Mesa, a 26-year-old third baseman who's basically Moncada's buddy. Yeah, I don't know what else to really say about that.
Reportedly, we don't know the exact relationship, but let's, you know.
Okay, fair.
We can't. We don't know what is fact. So reportedly, they're friends or something.
And just to a little background on him, he was an outfielder and pitcher in the Pirates organization from 2006 to 2013. And I believe, yeah, he was last season he was with an independent league team. So I don't think it's a, you know, a big signing other than the fact that, you know, he may be sort of a mentor or know Moncada in some way. But, you know, we don't know all the details on that. So.
Interesting. And that's really all that Merritt's mentioned. Although I'm seeing one tweet that calls him 26 and another one tweet calls him a 26-year-old third baseman. Another tweet calls him a 27-year-old outfielder.
I'm looking at an article and it says that his agent referred to him as 26-year-old third baseman, and it appears Hastings is referring to 27-year-old Carlos Mesa. So it sounds like his agent just had it wrong.
There you go. There you go. And now you know, and knowing is half the battle. We did have a couple other things we wanted to mention post-interview. One thing that I wanted to mention, you may have heard Ben refer to a license, or the general license granted by OFAC, which is the Office of Foreign Assets Control, I believe. We may have touched on this briefly in a past podcast, but basically the Cliff's Notes version is that OFAC gives out two licenses to, I guess it's come to the U.S. to live and to work, right?
It's for sanctioned countries.
For sanctioned countries, exactly. Thank you. They have the general license, which is achieved much easier than the specific license. Up through the signing of Yasiel Puig, MLB only required the general license, which is basically achieved by declaring residency in a non-sanctioned state, such as, you know, the Dominican or Haiti or Guatemala or something like that. The specific license involves a much deeper investigation into the person. And after Puig, MLB started requiring the specific license before it would allow teams to sign a player. That changed recently, where OFAC basically met with MLB and said they're only doing the general one now, I think is what really happened, right?
Yeah, they basically just said, we're not giving out the specific license anymore for this situation. So,
right. So at this point, that's when they decided to declare Moncada a free agent and when the bidding started.
Yeah, I think Kylie McDaniel of Fangraphs was the one who was all over this. So if you want to check it out more, I'd recommend going on Fangraphs and looking through his archive. You can find it. But just the general idea was that Major League Baseball, basically, there was a delay because they were seeking assurances, I guess, that they maybe wouldn't get in trouble if someone was basically, because they weren't doing that more of a background check anymore or whatever for the specific license, that baseball just wanted certain assurances before they were willing to grant accept the general license again.
Credit where it's due. I think Jeff Passan over at Yahoo did some reporting on that issue as well, off the top of my head. But yeah, Kylie McDaniel's stuff was leading the way on that as well. Also, Matt had a couple of things that were really grinding his gears that he wanted to talk about that I think are worth mentioning. The first off, which was a question that I know I got, and I'm assuming you guys saw this getting asked on Twitter as well, of whether the signing of Moncada would make the Red Sox more likely to trade for a Cole Hamels type because now they have another asset. I responded no. Matt, I know you had a lot of thoughts on that.
Well, no, I didn't have a lot more on that. You know, no, basically, I agree.
Right.
I mean, you know, they already had a really deep system. You're already dealing from a position of strength. And, you know, more to the point, it's about value. And just because, you know, they have a bunch of players, they don't want to give away great, you know, potentially guys that they've evaluated as really good players who are cost controlled. So, you know, it's all about value. So, no, I don't really think it changes much at all.
And the thing that I mentioned on Twitter, too, is that the signing of Yoan Moncada suddenly doesn't make Blake Swihart less valuable.
Right.
You know, the signing of a switch-hitting infielder does not make the switch-hitting very good defensive catcher less important.
Right. Like, if Yoan Moncada was a catcher, then maybe, sure. Yeah, we'd have more of a conversation.
But. Sure. But that's the thing, is that a lot of their high-end talent doesn't really overlap all that much. And I guess just to say something really quick, too, I've seen something about a log jam that this adds to. I couldn't disagree more. I think
not a real thing.
No. And he slides into a spot in the system where the Red Sox have kind of a prospect gap in this kind of Portland / guys who aren't going to be in Salem all year gap. There really isn't that much there. He kind of slots in the same development track where Manuel Margot is right now, I think, where, you know, maybe first half of the season in Salem, second half in Portland, there's nothing there. You know, Moncada's going to be well ahead of Devers and Chavis at third base if they put him at third. You know, the positional thing is something you cross that bridge when guys are in the majors. So the other thing, Matt, that you mentioned had to do with value. And where the Red Sox are spending money on value, and I thought that was a good point.
Yeah, this was the thing that was grinding my gears more. just that, you know, I think I heard on the radio today someone talking about how, you know, they're inconsistent. They've been inconsistent in how they're willing to spend their money, and especially referring to Lester versus some of these young guys like Rosny Castillo and Moncada, obviously. And I just couldn't disagree more. First of all, there's a huge difference between $60 million and $150 or, you know, whatever with options, more than that, $170 that Lester got. Second of all, my biggest disagreement is that the whole point is that you're paying for future performance versus paying for past performance with Lester. I mean, you know, obviously there's an argument to be made that, you know, Lester can continue the performance. That's why the Cubs signed him. But the idea is that you never, you know, like Theo Epstein feeding the monster type stuff. You don't want to pay for the past performance and get locked into players, you know, you have a attachment to. In this case, yeah, he's unproven, but the risk you're taking is a lot smaller. And the idea is that you could potentially save a ton of money because you're getting a potential superstar in his prime years at a cost control price. So, I mean, I think it's totally separate, and also the fact, you know, the fact that Lester is a pitcher at you know, over the age of 30, obviously factors into that as well, with the larger injury, you know, injury issues at that age.
Mm-hmm. Well said. All right. Anything to add?
No, that was very well said. Yeah, that was good.
Yeah. One more thing that I think we should mention, a question we're getting on Twitter, where he's going to rank. I think we've kind of reached a consensus among the Sox prospects brass that we're going to start Moncada at number two in the system, in part because we just haven't seen him, and in part because we will see him when we go to spring training near the end of March. So I think we all kind of view that as a tentative ranking pending us getting eyes on him in Fort Myers, and then from there we may reevaluate. It's kind of a luxury we have that, say, Baseball America, who has to make a call now, does not have. I know personally, had we, you know, if we were locked into the ranking right now, I may have pushed a little harder to rank him number one, but at the same time, I'm cool with ranking him number two. To me, it's basically him and Swihart are in a tier by themselves in the system, and then there's everybody else. Does that sound right to you guys?
Yeah, I think the thing that I personally would have said Swihart one, and we've been pretty adamant about it also, that I just look at it, we're talking about a guy, as Ben mentioned, who hasn't played in a game since December 2013. So we're looking at, we're pushing, what, a year and a half before he's going to play his first game, or since he's played his last game. And the other thing for me, the big separator for me, is Swihart's in Pawtucket. He's close to big league ready. If Swihart was on a bad team that wanted to push him, he could start in the big leagues this year. I'm pretty confident in saying that. But he's not going to, obviously, with the Red Sox. Like, he could handle his, hold his own in the big leagues this year. He's not going to, but start at least. But yeah, versus Moncada's going to be starting in low A or high A. A ball, probably. Like, that's a pretty, I mean, obviously he could move through very quickly, but it's just, there's a lot of unknowns right now, whereas we know what Swihart is. We've seen him a lot. We know he can hit. He's already dominated A ball and double A. So let's give Moncada a little time. He'll have his moment eventually.
Would you say it's a floor versus ceiling argument almost? Not saying that, you know, Swihart has a low ceiling or anything, but.
Yeah, I also think some of it is the unknown is intriguing in this situation, though. Because I was a little surprised that they were that adamant that he was number 10. Obviously, I mean, we have not, I've never seen him other than video, and I have not talked to anyone who's seen him. But just based on that, I was a little surprised that they were that sure that he was number 10. But granted, I mean, it was what, I think they have Swihart 13 or something. So it's not like it's that big a difference. But still, I think if you're looking at ceiling, it's from what, based on Ben, what Ben talked about, it seems, I mean, it's a Rule 7 ceiling, all-star player. I would argue Swihart has a similar ceiling.
Yep.
Maybe it's a tick lower. Maybe it's like a 65 ceiling versus a Rule 7, but yeah.
They have Swihart at 17 and would drop to 18 with the addition of Moncada.
So it's not a huge gap, but
no.
Still, that was a little surprising. I guess, I mean, they're obviously very bullish on him, and it sounds like based on how much money was spent, the Red Sox are also, so we shall see.
Definitely. Okay, so I think the other thing that we wanted to at least mention really quick is today the Pawtucket Red Sox, and what would have been a very big story if it hadn't been overshadowed this morning by the Moncada signing, which actually that's how I heard about Moncada, come to think of it, Matt, was your email about Moncada. I emailed the staff saying we should get someone on this Paw Sox sale thing, and then you replied with, it's going to be overshadowed by Moncada anyway. And that was how I heard, come to think of it. So, but yeah, the Pawtucket Red Sox were sold to a group of New England businessmen that includes Lucky Larry Lucchino, as well as as Fenway Sports Management is also a partner. And there are a few other people in there that I'm sure no one's heard of. That, you know, that was one thing that had been speculated and reported. But the new news was that this group apparently intends to move the team. The speculation is that they'll move the team to Providence. That's definitely not set in stone. And even the mayor of Pawtucket, who went on WPRO, I think is the station down there, the news station. It's 6:30 a.m., I know that. But the mayor of Pawtucket went on and said that, at first he was saying that the team is going to be moved, but then he said that the group that bought the team told him they would at least listen to what Pawtucket had to say. So I'm not quite sure what to make of what was reported there. But anyways, speculation is the team would move to Providence, where they'd get a new park on the city's waterfront, I believe, or at least one of the places would be on the waterfront that was reclaimed when they moved Route 195. while I was living in Providence, actually. Gentlemen, any kind of response to this, thoughts, feedback? It's certainly not a small deal, but in the grand scheme of things, I see it as a net positive. How about you?
Yeah, well, I was going to mention Alex Speer also confirmed that the ownership group does plan to move to Providence, but obviously that could change. But that's, you know, he has confirmed that at least. But I mean, I would agree with you that it's a positive, other than nostalgic reasons, and especially like the nickname is so ingrained. You know, you still call them the Paw Sox, even though they're thinking of moving. It's like, yeah, the Paw Sox are moving, but
we had a great discussion about this on Twitter.
Yeah, what their new nickname will be.
What their new name's going to be. I like Rye Sox. Yeah. For Rhode Island Sox.
Well, what were the finalists? It was Pro Sox, Prov Sox.
I thought they were Sox. Changing it to the Rhode Island Red Sox is what they want to change it to, though. Yeah, not the Providence Red Sox.
Yeah, someone suggested Rye Sox.
That was me.
And then, yeah, was that you? Yeah. And then someone else suggested Rhodey Sox, which I thought was pretty good.
Interesting.
But yeah, I mean, Ian can tell you that, you know, other people have mentioned the sight lines for scouting are pretty terrible there.
It sucks.
Brutal. It's awful. A friend of mine I was texting with who also lived in Providence for a while was saying that too.
It's the worst park to scout in I've ever been to.
And just, I mean, the area is fine, but it's like, it's kind of the middle of residential area and then like schools. It's not really ideal as far as what they're talking about as far as a destination, and especially having a college nearby would definitely be a big thing. I don't know about Providence traffic. That's the one thing that would concern me getting in and out of Providence, but
yeah, I mean, so Providence rush hour traffic isn't that great. And I think that that is a fair point. I think in moving the team, yeah, you may lose some people who come regularly from Southern Mass, the kind of Attleboro, you know, North Attleboro area there. But what are some other towns in that area? I can't even remember. But I think you would instead gain some people who are in Providence or maybe a little south of Providence in like the Warwick type areas that couldn't get north. Because if you're not familiar with the area, there's an area of 95 that bottlenecks basically in Providence.
I work in Warwick, so I mean, to get to Pawtucket at game time takes me like, you know, probably 40 minutes. And it's like,
that's terrible.
You know, it's like a 15 minute drive at most when there's no traffic.
Yeah. So that stretch of 95 is just terrible. Brutal. But I think that you would get, you know, more of the southern people who in theory could just hop on 95 and get off at 195 before the bottleneck, which would be a lot easier. And if, you know, you're going to have a new park, I could see them building up that entire area around it. They've been kind of debating what to do with that reclaimed area on the waterfront. And I think that would be a great idea if there's room for a ballpark. I think that would be outstanding as an anchor for that area. And then, you know, maybe build up some commercial area around there, some shopping, some restaurants, you know, get water fire going, you know, as often as they used to do it. I think they still do it, but not nearly as much, right? It would be very, I think it would be a great thing for Providence. You know, that, like you said, that area of Pawtucket, it's not dangerous by any stretch. It's just there's nothing there. There's one little dive bar that fills up, you know, when 20 people are in it. It's tough to even go in. You know, like I remember going to see Dylan at McCoy once, so I wasn't, you know, working, and we went over there, and it was just kind of like, it wasn't even fun, because, you know, you're four deep at this tiny bar, but
I saw Dylan there too, actually, interestingly.
Oh, the one with Mellencamp and William Nelson?
Yeah, and I think we might have discussed this before, actually.
Oh, okay, cool, yeah, well, we'll stop so we don't bore everybody, but, yeah, but so I could see it as a net positive. It kind of stinks for the city of Pawtucket, but that said, given how there's nothing in that area, I think all they were really getting out of it was jobs, right? I mean, they weren't getting people staying in their hotels or, I mean, I'm sure the visiting teams were probably staying in Providence, right?
Yeah, probably.
And so, Yeah, I don't think the city of Pawtucket's necessarily losing a ton. Like I said on our forum, I think I could see them knocking down McCoy Stadium and replacing it with a warehouse.
It would fit in better in that area.
You know?
Yeah.
It's just really weird where it is.
Yeah, there's schools, industrial place to one side, then houses to another side.
Yeah. Like I usually would park in the middle of the residential area to go to a baseball game, which is kind of absurd.
That's the one thing that might be tough too, is parking might be, you know, free parking might be more of an issue there. But
Yeah. But at the same time, I mean, it's not like this is, you know, a conglomerate that's going to take over the Paw Sox / whatever they're getting called, and they're going to make the prices like Fenway prices or something. You know, this is still going to be a minor league team. The Red Sox own the Salem Red Sox, and it's not like that turned into some disaster. In fact, it's been great for the franchise. So, you know, I don't think this is going to be some horrible thing like a lot of people are decrying. So we'll see what they do. Just as long as they don't name them the Rhode Island Red Sox of the Rhode Island Red Sox of Providence and or what did I call it?
The Providence Plantations.
Pawtucket Red Sox of Rhode Island and Providence Plantations. Which, to explain the joke to everyone, the official name of the state of Rhode Island is the state of Rhode Island and Providence Plantations.
Right.
Which is obviously a cause for some consternation for readily apparent reasons. So, okay, well, we've probably beat this to death, gentlemen. I know I need to go produce this and get it out for the people. And
bring it to the people.
Bringing it to the people. Bringing it to the streets.
That's right. That's what we do
with El Chombo. All right. Well, on behalf of these two guys, assuming they have nothing else to say, my name's Chris Hatfield. For Matt and Ian, we want to thank you for downloading. We'll be recording another episode sometime soonish. I think I don't know what our original plan, how that's going to be affected by the fact that we hammered this one out tonight, but we'll be back soon. Make sure you follow the news page. Make sure you check out the new scouting reports. I almost didn't even mention. Ian and Chaz Fiorino have been doing a great job updating the scouting reports on the website. We have new scouting reports for the top 20 as of right now, not including Yoan Moncada yet. Scouting reports for prospects 21 through 40 will be going up later this week, hopefully. But from there, we're going to go position by position with just updating the old-style reports. But the new scouting reports have all the tools broken out. They're fantastic. I can't say enough what a great job those two guys did on that project. And we want to thank all of our staffers who helped with compiling some information to check our information against. So there's a post about it on the news page, news.soxprospects.com. And I think that's it. So thanks for downloading, everybody. And we'll be back in your eardrums very soon. Can you look at the mirror?